My name is Phil Grabsky, and I am the co-director, co-author, and producer of My Childhood, My Country, 20 Years in Afghanistan.
And it is, you know, a new documentary that's going to be coming out. What date is it released? Do you know? Do you remember?
So we have a kind of rolling release. So the first cinema screenings are actually this Friday in Los Angeles. And then, you know, because of COVID, it's very hard to do a general release. So it'll be released at different times in different cinemas. So, for example, in Washington, D.C., our friends at the Avalon will show it later this year. And internationally, just, you know, also we're showing it on different television stations at different times. My own TV station, ITV in Britain, is showing 12 times, which is, you know, makes it very current.
For sure, for sure. Well, I guess my question is there, would you want me to run it this, you know, this interview, would you want me to run it this week timed with the LA thing, or wait until our listeners can see it? Or, I mean, I feel like with the Afghanistan, the troop pullout, I feel like it's kind of timely to run it sooner rather than later.
I think it's timely to run it now.
Yeah.
I think that the conversation that we'll have will, you know, the film and the issues in the film we can cover in this interview, and it's all about communicating that to an audience. And your show is as important as a cinema screening, as a television screening. So yeah, the sooner the better.
All right, sounds good. Well, why don't you, obviously it's called My Childhood, My Country, 20 Years in Afghanistan. Why don't you just sort of tell okay, our listeners the approach? I mean the way it was pitched to me was, you know, is relating it to sort of Richard Linklater's Boyhood, but this is like a real life incremental thing, a documentary style, in a very timely topic.
Well, I think it's fair to say that this is a very unique film, in that I flew out to Afghanistan in July of 2002, and the technologies had changed in terms of cameras and filmmaking, which meant I could essentially go on my own with a, you know, very good camera and with one Afghan translator, fixer, co-producer. I went in search of a story. Why did I go to Afghanistan? Well, Afghanistan, of course, had been in the news the previous year. The Buddha's of Bamiyan was a big story, which was blown up by the Taliban. Then the fall of the Taliban following 9/11, and of course which was precipitated by the NATO-US invasion of Afghanistan. But what struck me as a documentary filmmaker is we weren't really talking very much about the Afghan people. Who were the Afghan people? There's no way that every Afghan male was going to be bearded, malevolent, you know, a potential terrorist. That's just nonsense. And similarly, who were the Afghan women? They can't all be mute behind their blue infamous burqas. So I thought, I'm a filmmaker, I'll go and find out for myself. And I did. I flew into Kabul. I remember I got visa number 37 from the new embassy in London. So it was all very new. Kabul was extraordinary. One of my previous television, I mean, I've been making documentaries for 35 years, and one of the previous films was about the fall of Berlin. And if you've ever seen footage of Berlin in 1945, well, Kabul was the same. It was wrecked. There wasn't one standing lamppost, planes upside down, tanks everywhere, mines everywhere. But I didn't want to make a film in Kabul. That was too obvious. So I went out into the countryside and I thought, actually, I'll go to the one city that people have heard of, which is Bamiyan. Now, in Bamiyan, alongside those destroyed Buddhas, which were carved into a cliff face, they were the tallest stone statues in the world until the Taliban destroyed them needlessly. There are 200 caves full of refugees, internally displaced refugees. And to cut a long story short, that's where I found the cheekiest, funniest, cutest little boy called Mir. And I thought,
how do you spell Mir?
Mir, M-I-R.
Okay.
Ironically, Russian for peace, although that's just kind of a coincidence. And I thought, if I follow his story for a year, on and off, I couldn't live in Afghanistan for a year, but I went backwards and forwards. it will make us think about what is the future of Afghanistan. So rather than just making a film about the past and talking to people about experiences they'd had, which of course had been awful, you know, the Russian invasion and the Mujahideen and the civil war and then the Taliban. I mean, it's a very bleak period the Afghan nation's been through. I mean, an estimated 2 million, can you imagine 2 million people killed? That's just utterly extraordinary. But when the Taliban fell and the Americans and 40 other nations came in, there was a real sense of joy, actually, and hope and optimism. And I thought I could capture that by following this little boy's life and seeing, you know, what changed for him and what changed for his family. So I made a film which was called The Boy Who Plays on the Buddhas of Bamiyan. Now, this kind of rode the wave of new, you know, there was an upsurge of interest in documentary filmmaking about this time, largely driven by Michael Moore, because his film started making money and cinemas and distributors react to commercial gain. So he played in lots of festivals. We had, in the end, we kind of managed the cinema release ourselves, but we had lots of cinema screenings and lots of television screenings. But it was an uncomfortable feeling for me because I won an award in Washington. I won an award in Santa Barbara, and et cetera, et cetera. But I felt uncomfortable. You know, I was getting kind of plaudits for the film, but I had no idea really how the kid was getting on, because it was, you know, one of the things that has really changed and has transformed Afghanistan is that when I went, there were virtually no mobile phones. Now everyone has a mobile phone. And this is, I mean, interestingly, this is one of the things that the new Taliban regime is having to deal with, which we might come on to, but it's why that Afghan society now is not the same as it was 25 years ago. And I do make the argument that there's nothing black and white about Afghanistan, but anybody that says it has been a complete waste of time doesn't know Afghanistan, because it's not true. Anyway.
So explain what you mean by that. Explain what you mean that, you know, that there's, you know, we're watching these images on our screens and, you know, it's heartbreaking, you know, people chasing, yeah, trying to, after airplanes trying to evacuate and all kinds of stuff. And it's probably easy for folks. I mean, I have friends that served, you know, and it must be easy for them to say, dang, what was it all for? It was a waste. But explain what you mean why it wasn't a waste.
Well, first of all, I have to preface this by saying that, you know, the level of loss, the level of cost, I think an individual has to decide whether it was worth it or not. There were 2,600 NATO soldiers that lost their lives, and an estimated 160,000 Afghans have lost their lives in the last 20 years. But if you take the US Army, take the British Army, 437 soldiers, I believe, you know, military people have lost their lives. And, you know, there are people on the television right now in the UK saying it was a complete waste of time. Nothing's changed. Look, the Taliban are back. What a complete failure. That shows actually a bit of naivety. Afghanistan has changed. So it is a very young country. It's about 35 to 37 million people. It's one of the youngest countries in the world, which in itself is a mark of how the last 20 years has allowed for a degree of regrowth, a literal rebirth. You have teenagers, 18, 17, 18, 19-year-olds who were born after the fall of the Taliban. And they virtually all, I mean, there is a difference between the cities and the rural communities, of course, but basically everybody has a mobile phone. Everyone's connected to the World Wide Web. The kind of music that young people are listening to in Washington, D.C., they're listening to in Afghanistan. They're looking at YouTube. They're looking at Facebook. That changes. And you also have civil society that's been encouraged. You know, women have been encouraged. One quarter of parliamentarians were women. That's more than Britain, certainly more than the United States. 256 judges were women. So they've also been encouraged to become professionals, to play their part. And the Taliban are very smart. at times they're extraordinarily brutal, and you know, evil's not too strong a word to talk in some senses, but they're also pragmatic, realistic, and you know, I don't condone it in any sense, but they're smart in the sense that they realize that this is a different Afghanistan. If they're to control, you know, they'll struggle to control civil society if they behave, I think, and I hope, and this is also partly an optimistic view, they try to just dominate society through force. They know that they're going to struggle. So therefore, the platitudes that they're, you know, going through at the moment, they're talking about, you know, we want a united Afghanistan. We want women and professionals to stay and to work. The proof will be in the pudding, obviously. But part of that is a realization that things have to some extent changed. Now, this is reflected in the film. You know, there has been investments in all sorts of things, surrounding countries coming in with all sorts of projects and gas pipelines and electricity, and the Chinese are trying to build a railroad and mining rights, and, you know, millions of mines have been cleared, debris from the previous wars has been cleared. So things are different. However, Jason, what you have to also to say is that the military, and this is where it all got a bit confused, when the military suddenly started to be made responsible for development and political advance, and you're giving brigade commanders or company commanders cash to hand out. The military were there to provide to give the space for a political settlement of some sort. That had all, you know, that had to be a long-term thing. I mean, as soon as Iraq happened that Afghanistan was going to, you know, that was terrible for Afghanistan because all the attention suddenly went to another country. And I make the point in the film, or there's an end card, which I say that, you know, the military spend was 30 times higher than the aid spend. That was a mistake. The idea that you can do this short term is a mistake. There were too many people in military uniform and not enough in civilian clothes. You know, a real opportunity has been lost. And what's happening now is tremendously sad, you know, because these are the most wonderful people. And, you know, I'm sure many of your listeners will know wonderful Afghans already in the United States, some of whom went back. I know people in the United States who went back after 2001 to try and rebuild society, and then they left again because the government there was corrupt, or they were threatened, or the drug dealers, you know, threatened them. And so there's an opportunity lost. But we shouldn't think that Afghanistan is today in 2021 what it was in the mid 1990s.
So you're saying that, you know, that it's not like 20 years just vanished and was erased, that even though there might not be an American or British or NATO presence, that the 20 years of advancements, you can't just, you know, that you can't put that genie back in the bottle, and somehow maybe that will help counterbalance the more dangerous parts of the Taliban rule.
I mean, look, there's plenty of interviews I've heard of wonderful, strong, professional, educated women who are desperate to get on planes and are saying that the past 20 years has been wiped out. I'm not counter arguing that at all. You know, they are there, they're on the ground. Their opinion is worth more than mine. What I would say, though, is that all the efforts of those NGOs and many military people, many government people, I don't think we can kind of whitewash it and say complete waste of time, because I don't believe that's the case. I think that, you know, and I have my view, but I'm also getting this from Afghans that I talk to, that, you know, the fact that there were so many television channels in Afghanistan. All right, now some of them will perhaps now be shut down. I've heard that some have already been shut down. Maybe female TV presenters will no longer be allowed. That's terrible, horrible. But nevertheless, you know, the new Afghan population, in fact, Afghanistan as a whole, is now used to multiple feeds of news, multiple channels. It's very hard to put those, as you say, genies back in the bottle. There have been 2, 3, 4 million girls educated, perhaps only up to a fairly junior level, but there were none under the previous regime, none. And, you know, Mir's wife, so my character, Mir, we followed him for 20 years. And he's also, I say it myself, but it's a remarkable, we couldn't believe the things that kept happening to him. And in the end, he ends up in Kabul and actually becomes a news cameraman. But along the way, he marries the most wonderful woman who is just tremendous and articulate and ambitious. And, you know, women like her are not just going to, well, you know, I have to say, it does depend on the level of violence. And you can't deny that men with guns are, you know, a terrible scourge on society. But, you know, they're used now. You know, she wants to be educated. Many of her friends have been educated. And it's very hard to kind of shut that back down again. Of course, that's the great shame of things, which is that that is maybe what will happen. It's hard to tell. I mean, we've all seen the horrors of Syria, where you had a more advanced society, highly educated society. I've been to Syria. I really like Syria and the Syrians. And that was completely destroyed. I think it's been completely destroyed. And ISIS were murderous. I just hope that it's not too optimistic for me to say that I think there's a difference between the Taliban, evil though they have been, and ISIS. I just hope, and I'm an optimistic soul, I just hope that the Taliban's platitudes and what they're saying at the moment will bear some fruit and will, but you know, there'll be some truth to it. You know, it is interesting. I doubt that there would have been a situation in Syria where they would even have allowed the airport to stay open for 2 weeks. And these troops, these armies that they've been fighting for 20 years, you know, violently, to allow them to stay in the airport and extricate thousands and thousands of professional people, you know, even that shows something. And if American troops say, well, you know, they couldn't stop us, that's nonsense. If the Taliban wanted to shut down the airport tomorrow, they'd shut it down. It would take them 10 minutes. You know, don't believe any bravado that America can defend the airport, because they haven't been able to defend the country. They're not going to be able to defend the airport. So the Taliban are allowing them. That in itself is something to hold on to. All those images on the road to the airport are very scary, and I wouldn't want to be anywhere near it. But again, you know, that's just partly the result of just tens of thousands of people desperate to get out. It's very hard to control at the best of time. You know, we saw how difficult it was for the American police to defend Congress, and recently the British police have struggled once or twice to, you know, in battling against crowds in central London. I mean, it's difficult. So it's sad, it's messy, it's distressing. But what our film shows, albeit the film has lots of humor and adventure and drama, it shows that things have changed. There has been development, but unfortunately, towards the end of the film, we hear both Mir and his wife talking optimistically about the future. And as I speak to you now, they are trying to leave. So, you know, the ending of the film is not quite resolved, but it's looking sad.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, we've talked a lot, and thanks for going so in depth on, you know, the socio-political sort of backdrop and the history of everything. But tell me a little bit, I want to know a little bit more about the character you follow, you know, Mir. So you pick him up at age 7 in a cave with a bunch of refugees. How did you, does his you know, family? Do his parents, are they with him, or is he, you know, orphaned? Do they give you permission to follow him? You know, how does that first initial meeting happen?
So I'm in the middle of Afghanistan in a situation where a few months earlier under the Taliban, I would be arrested. So I've gone there on my own with my Afghan colleague, and I'll just tape one in Bamiyan early in the morning. I had permission from the local warlord to be there. That was very important. The only thing he said to me was, you can't stay in the caves. That's too dangerous. So he actually put me into a house in Bamiyan. But early in the morning, 6 o'clock, 6:15, when the sun came up, I got up and went without my fixer, went on my own down to the Buddhas, or what was left of them. They were rubble, they had been destroyed. And as I walked up to the Buddhas to have a look, I had my tripod and my camera. There were three men with shovels, and they were actually sweeping up the rubble and putting it into wheelbarrows. And I thought to myself, well, here goes, let's see what happens. And I was a little cautious, so I didn't actually connect the camera. I rested the camera on the tripod. I didn't actually connect it because I thought, if they come for me, I'm going to have to run fast. But, you know, I'm a runner, so I knew I could outrun them. I couldn't really speak to them. I said hello in Dari, but that's about the limit at that point of my Dari. And I thought, what's going to happen now? And they started singing and dancing. And one of them jumped in the wheelbarrow and started singing to me. And at that point, I thought, okay, this is going to be all right. But I'm still, you know, over the next few days, you know, you're still in a difficult situation where people don't really know who you are and what you're doing. And so it was quite nice for me to kind of meet this young boy, and couldn't really talk to each other, but we could communicate in other ways. And yes, he was living with his family. It's an unusual family, as you'll see in the film, but his father was, who unfortunately died during the making of the film, but was a fantastic character. The mother is very strong, and in fact was, you know, extremely rude on camera, which Afghans, I mean, one of the things I've discovered along the way is that Afghans absolutely love this film because they never, ever see Afghans portrayed honestly. And part of that honesty is seeing, you know, these two going at each other, hammer and tongs, and swearing at each other. And I didn't anticipate this, but when I've released the previous film about these family, the Afghan audiences absolutely loved it because they were seeing their own families represented on film, on camera, on the big screen in a way they'd just never seen before. So I was very lucky to kind of hook up with this family. And they were happy to be filmed. And one of the things, Jason, that surprised me was that I decided right at the beginning that I wanted my characters to speak. There's going to be no narration from me. I wasn't a part of this film. And I didn't want to do that slightly odd thing that we all do in television, which is do an interview where the person that's speaking is talking off camera. We're all used to it. We don't question it, but actually it's a bit odd. I had my characters talking straight to camera. Now, they'd never seen a camera before. And sometimes I had a wide angle lens on, or a particular lens on, which meant I got quite close to them. And sometimes because of the light out there, because Bamiyan's quite high, I had a polarizer on. So sometimes they're almost looking at a mirror because of the reflect, you know, the polarizer lens is quite reflective. And yet they were fantastic. The boy, the father, the brother-in-law would talk straight to camera. And, you know, when it was translated for me, and, you know, it was articulate and honest and funny. They were unbelievable. I mean, you'll hear this about the Afghans. They were unbelievably hospitable. I mean, and they were desperately poor. Now, there are a number of things that you learn from the film, but one of them is that if you want to understand Afghanistan, and this applies to other countries too, but if you want to understand Afghanistan, you have to understand they are desperately poor. and they make decisions on the basis of the fact that they are desperately poor. So, you know, even after $2.6 trillion has been invested in Afghanistan, you've got 40% unemployment. That's a lot of young men easily led because they have no options. My family that I film, I mean, it's almost medieval in European terms, at least, in the sense that the first priority, you know, until about a couple of hundred years ago, 95% of the world's population was engaged in the production and distribution of food. Now, in the United States and in the United Kingdom, most of us are very fortunate. We can just go to a supermarket and buy food. That wasn't true 200-400 years ago, and it's not true in many countries today. So in Afghanistan, my family, for example, you'll see it in the film, one stage, they have to rent a very poor bit of land on the side of a hill, which is very rocky. They have to clear all those rocks with donkeys and bullocks and a plow. They have to buy grain. They have to plant the grain. They are at the mercy of climate change, like everywhere else. And in fact, even this year, they've been suffering a drought. If they're lucky, that grain grows. They then take it to the water mill, where it's ground into flour. 10% is given to the guy who owns the water mill as a fee. That has provided them with flour to have bread, which is their staple diet. And you'll see in the film, the thing that they're eating most often is just bread. Occasionally, they might get some meat. Very rarely do they have fruit and vegetables. I mean, and Mir says at one point, he says, you know, if we can't eat, I can't go to school. And in fact, he's a very smart, you'll love this character. He's very smart and very engaging, but his education is interrupted by the need to help his family survive. Anyway, so I was just lucky, really. Lucky in that as he grew up, he remained engaging and ambitious and, you know, he went through all these kind of adventures, and you just wanted to know what he would do next. You want to hear what he has to say. He's delightful in his relation. You know, his relationship with his family is funny. His relationship with his new wife is funny. And you also feel sorry for him because you see the struggles in his, you know, in his demeanor, in his face. You know that he could do better. That said, as we get towards, I don't want to give too much away, but as we get towards the end of the film, things start working out for him in Kabul. He has some close shaves because Kabul is, you know, you could have a relatively decent life, but if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, the Taliban or ISIS were going to get you. And that's why it's very sad that right now, because he'd always said, I don't want to leave. You know, he had friends that had gone to Iran or gone to Europe, legally or illegally. And he said, I don't want to leave. I want to help build my country. And now is the first time that he is saying, no, I have to leave. I have to go now. The other stroke of luck I had, Jason, was that, and there is no film without this guy. I very early on met somebody, an Afghan filmmaker who I hooked up with because I knew that one, he would have more time in Kabul, and he lives in Kabul. And two, he would just get me even more access to this family. I had very good access myself, but I kind of wanted more of an Afghan involvement and perspective. So we co-direct, the film that we're releasing now is co-directed by myself and Shraib. And he is the most remarkable man. And he there's no film without him. And he built up a fabulous bond with this family. And so, you know, you're seeing the inside of an Afghan family that I guarantee you've simply not seen before. And I might have started that process, but Shuaib's the one that kept that carrying on for year after year. And, you know, it's these films are not, you know, you've done many interviews, I know, with many filmmakers, and we'll all talk about the difficulties. But these types of documentaries are extraordinarily difficult to do. partly because they're not, you know, it's very practically impossible to raise the funding, and partly because you have to be questioning everything, you know, to make sure that you're being honest, asking the right questions, filming the right scenes, being respectful, not putting anyone in danger, and making as cinematic a film as you possibly can, or as televisual a film as you possibly can, which is, you know, always a challenge.
Oh, absolutely. It's amazing what you've pulled off. And I know Zoom is showing I only have like 6 minutes left. So, but in closing, I want to make sure I have it all buttoned up in terms of sort of logistical details. So how many trips did you make back and forth from London to Afghanistan? Like, how many different filming expeditions were there?
Well, between Shuaib and I, there were, between us, we're filming Mir once or twice a year. And when, over the last few decades, while Shuaib has lived in Kabul, then he could be called upon to film anytime. So, excuse me one second. So, obviously, we're not filming Mir all the time.
Sure.
And, you know, there's plenty of domestic footage which is not in the film because it added nothing to the film. There was a, you know, I have a visa to go to Afghanistan and was planning to go in 3 weeks' time. That's obviously not going to happen. I haven't been for some years now. It's been Shuaib. My job has been to keep the whole thing rolling and oversee the edit here and talk to Shuaib and encourage him to go out and film. And
yeah, are you editing it as you go along over the last 20 years, or is the editing mostly been recently?
So along the way, there were two films made. There was one released in 2004. Called The Boy Who Plays on the Buddhas of Bamiyan.
Right, you mentioned that, yeah.
And then the only way I could find out how Mir was to go back. There was no other way of communicating with him. So I went back, took my camera. That was in 2005, I think. And then I decided, because they'd moved from Bamiyan back to their village in the north, I thought, I just, you know, 1-2 years is not enough to see what actually the impact of this intervention is going to be. So I decided, working with Shuaib now, I decided to make a film which ultimately was called The Boy Mir, 10 Years in Afghanistan. Now, I'll be honest, that was challenging. And when we released it, partly people were bored of Afghanistan, I have to say. I thought that would be it. I thought, you know, that's done. I must admit, I was a bit shaken by an encounter with the Taliban. My family had always been very supportive, but they said, look, okay, I think it's, you know, time to wrap this up. But then one TV station, WDR in Germany, who are with a particular couple of women that work there, came to me and said, we're really keen to know what happens. We've loved the first two films. Our audience has loved the first two films. We'll support you. We'll give you some seed funding to carry on. And I talked to Shuaib and I said, okay, you know what? Let's do that. So we basically, we've carried on and made a 20-year. And apart from the 7-Up series, which was not quite the same, but still did follow a few children in Britain growing up. You'd come back to them every 7 years. And Boyhood, which of course was a real actor, but it was a drama. I've never seen anything like this. And I think that it absolutely, you know, it's fair to say that if you want any kind of insight into who the Afghan people are, who those people are struggling now to get out, turning up, in Washington or New York or San Francisco and many other countries around the world, they are families like Mir and his family. And, but also more broadly than that, it asks questions of, you know, how should we react? You know, as an international community, what should we do? when there are these sometimes dreadful governments like the Taliban, like Libya, like Iraq. And then if those governments do topple, then what do you do? And where do you put your resources? And the one political thing I'll say is that a ratio of 30-1 military to aid is a mistake, because that is not sustainable. And you were, frankly, even I as a non-military man knew you could never beat the Taliban. And if you use a drone and you kill some guy in a car, but you also kill his driver and three others and two civilians, you've just created another 25 Taliban. And they were happy to live in caves year after year, taking pot shots at poor American soldiers, young, fit men and women who really didn't deserve to be injured, never mind killed. You can't defeat them militarily. And, in Britain, if you look at the IRA, the unpleasant truth is that sometimes to defeat unpleasant regimes, you've got to come to an accommodation with them. You can't achieve everything through military might. And I don't think there was ever much chance in the short term of defeating the Taliban. In the long term, if we'd taken a long-term view and allowed the decades to pass, then maybe. But to try and achieve this in the short term was never going to succeed.